Hey everyone, this is Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal, and this is the Fretboard Journal's 58th podcast. Every week I try to talk to some of our favorite guitar players, guitar builders, guitar obsessives on this show. And this week we're going to talk to the archtop guitar builder, mandolin builder, Steve Anderson, who is actually in our neck of the woods here in Seattle. Steve has unveiled, it's actually right on his website if you want to check it out, he has invented a double top archtop guitar. I think it's the first one ever. He's got that on the front page of his website right now. It's sort of taking inspiration from the classical builders who do the ultra thin double top construction, but it's an archtop. It's got curves. We've been helping him kind of document the whole process, and we'll be posting videos on fretboardjournal.com soon. Been taking a ton of photos, interviewing him about that. But for this week's podcast, I actually wanted to go way back with him. Steve was one of the very first students at Roberto Venn School of Luthery in Phoenix, which we covered in Fretboard Journal 25. And I wanted to ask him about his earliest days building and his time, how he got to the Pacific Northwest from his home of Phoenix, and also talk to him about mandolins. He was actually quite the F-style mandolin builder for the longest time, and then he flipped the switch and now just focuses mainly on archtops, and I kind of wanted to get the origin of that. So consider this the first installment of a Steve Anderson podcast, but we have a nice half-hour-long talk where we chat about all this stuff in the early days of his building career. Before we get to that, two very quick announcements. If by some odd chance you're listening to this in time and you find yourself in Seattle, Fretboard Journal's 7th anniversary party is October 17th, which is tomorrow, one day from me recording this. Here in Seattle, you'll want to email me ASAP at jason@fretboardjournal.com. I'm going to be running around tomorrow doing party planning, getting the space ready and everything. But if I see your email, I will definitely email you the contact info and details on where it is. It's at a cool secret location in Seattle's Fremont neighborhood. And the party starts at 6 and goes till 9, maybe a little later. So that's going to be a lot of fun. Also, Fretboard Journal 26 is still available. We've got them here, and they are in stores everywhere, too. Cover story is Billy Gibbons being interviewed by Ian Moore, a great, cool interview about Texas music history. Also in that issue, if you're into luthiers, we've got an incredible T.J. Thompson article, about 20-plus pages long of him talking about his restoration work as well as his new creation. So that's really cool stuff in that issue, along with a lot more. Now, without further ado, here's Steve Anderson. Let's go way back.
Mm-hmm.
You went to Roberto Venn before it was Roberto Venn, right?
I did.
What was that like, and how did you stumble upon that?
Oh, my God. Well, I grew up in Phoenix, which is where Roberto Venn is located.
Mm-hmm.
I was in high school physics class, and I was learning to play guitar, and I remember these two guys in class were talking about this place they'd gone to over the weekend, and they talked about some crazy shop that was open and you could go in there and pay them money and they would tell you how to build a guitar. So I just thought, well, that sounds crazy. So I went and checked it out, and that was indeed true. It wasn't a school at all. It was in a Quonset hut in a really bad part of town in Tempe, Arizona. And they had a sign out front that said, "Build your own guitar here." And the basic premise was they were open from noon to midnight, 5 days a week. And you go in and you pay a few hundred dollars for a shop fee, and then you go in whenever you want to go in and wait for somebody to come and help you out. And so if John, the guy who ran the school, you know, was in watching TV or having coffee or having dinner, you waited till John was done. You know, it was just, he was kind of on his own little schedule. Or there would be some other people who are maybe one step ahead of you, some kind of trusted, mm-hmm. you know, slightly trusted other people there. So there were people who would come in once a week, and they would spend a year or 2 years to do this. Mm-hmm. Other people would come every day. You know, it's just you put in as much time as you want. And so I did that, and I ended up with made a guitar.
It was open till midnight. So did it become kind of a party as the night wore on?
No. It was kind of a social scene, and so there'd be kind of a core group of people. You know, there'd be, people in all sorts of professions, you know, maybe a school teacher or something who came in, you know, two nights a week after work or something like that. And then there were people who maybe didn't have jobs or, you know, just had a lot more free time, and they'd kind of go in all the time. Mm-hmm. Later, after it became a school, so this would have been in 1972 or something like that, kind of dating myself. A few years later, they got the idea, which was a great idea actually, to turn it into a school. Mm-hmm. And so they were able to work out a thing for VA funding. So they had quite a few vets who would do the program.
Okay.
And they would have people come from all over the U.S. And I lived in Phoenix. So I was one of the few locals.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing was they'd have these schools, maybe these classes that started maybe twice a year. And so you'd get, say, on September 1st, a new class starts. And so you get this group of 20 people from all over the U.S. And they have one reason to be in Phoenix, which is to go to Roberto Venn. And they generally are on a budget. And there was, it was a pretty rough part of town. So there'd be, people would rent a house, so there'd be, you know, six people living in one house. And that's all they did was go to school. And after school, they'd get together and they'd have a party or whatever, play music, and talk about, you know, guitars.
Wow.
So there was some pretty interesting parties. So that was kind of a scene, because you had just this little microcosm of people who were going to be there for 4 or 6 months, and they just hung out together, and that's all they did.
Who is there anyone I would recognize from that initial charter year?
names are Jason Lawler went early on. I'm not sure what year.
Yeah.
A guy named Mike Lennon, who's went on to be, I think, a kind of a Gibson repair specialist in Tennessee.
Okay.
There's some other people. I was there during that period, and then I kind of moved away, and so I haven't really kept up with the people, but. It was a pretty interesting experience. I mean, when I left there, I kind of realized when I left that it was a good introduction, but there was still a lot of things I wanted to learn.
Mm-hmm.
The early days, they had pretty strict ideas about, you know, what you could and could not do.
Mm-hmm.
And I think over time those things loosened up a little bit.
Yeah. And then you ended up in Idaho?
Yeah. I'd been to Sandpoint, Idaho, in mid-70s with my brother. And I knew that there was some guitar makers who were living there. I'd met one of them, a guy named Bob Brook. So in the meantime, a few years later, I went back and Bob Brook was still there, but there was some other builders, a mandolin and guitar maker named Bob Givens, mm-hmm. and a guitar maker named Nick Kukich, who builds under the name Franklin Guitars.
What was it? These days, people think of Healdsburg or Seattle or Portland as being kind of hubs of luthery. What was it about Sandpoint that drew all these guys?
Bob Brook was there, I think, early on. I think he'd been there for a while. The real common denominator was there was a mail order guitar store. Today that sort of thing is pretty common, but this was pretty funky. I mean, it was called Guitar's Friend, and this fellow had Lawrence Ostro had moved, I think, from Michigan. I think he'd had his store in Michigan, so he moved to Sandpoint, Idaho, and opened up this store. So it's a little walk-in store, but they had a pretty fancy hand-drawn catalog, and they carried factory guitars. Mm-hmm. Lawrence knew Nick Kukich, and I think kind of enticed Nick to move out there. And I don't know how Bob Givens came out, but I'm sure that Guitar's Friend has something to do with that. So it was really kind of an unusual concentration of builders. I met Nick, and he had a partner at the time, Tom Ruthenberg, and I think he had one employee. And I asked him for a job, and I had a guitar that I'd made in Phoenix. I'd made a few guitars since my days at Roberto Van, so I probably had six guitars I'd made by then. So I had something that I thought was pretty nice, and I showed it to him, and he offered me. He said I could work as an apprentice. And I kind of thought, well, oh boy, I don't really want to do that. I mean, I couldn't afford to. But I went. There was another company there called Musical Traditions that made dulcimers, and they hired me. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, I'll do this. So I worked for him for 6 months, and then Nick ended up offering me a job, and I said, oh, okay. And it's funny to think about it today. I was paid $25 a day, and which to me was, it was better than nothing.
Yeah.
And it was really cheap to live there. I was at that age; I could live pretty cheap. Mm-hmm. So I went to work for him, and man, it just opened my eyes. I had this guitar that I'd made that I thought was pretty nice, and man, just to see really, really high quality guitar being made and participate, mm-hmm. was really something. Kind of blew my mind.
How big did Franklin get? I mean, how many guitars were they putting out? How many employees?
Well, when I got hired, Lawrence Ostro, who owned Guitar's Friend, became kind of their broker.
Okay.
And so Lawrence put on a push, I guess he was selling guitars, and he said, okay, I want you to deliver, I don't remember what the number was, X number per month. And so Nick responded by saying, okay, well, I guess we need to hire some people. Mm-hmm. So at the biggest during that time, so this would have been about 1978, I think, 79, there was Nick and his partner and I think three full-time employees. So that went along. I was there for about 18 months, and then all of a sudden, in thinking back, I kind of think of it as the disco craze that kind of killed the guitar world.
Yeah.
But it's something, you know, the kind of the bottom fell out of the market, and all of a sudden Lawrence is saying, "Hey, hold up, I don't send you more guitars."
Yeah.
So I got fired, or laid off, or however you want to say it. I'd been planning on making guitars one way or another. And, you know, I'd been kind of buying tools off and on over the years. So pretty much within a few months, I went to an auction and bought a bunch of woodworking equipment and found a house and set up a shop in the basement and started putting together some guitars.
So the demise of orders didn't disappear. You kept at it. You didn't.
Oh yeah.
We're in.
When I was working for Nick, you know, I played guitar, but somebody loaned me a cheapo mandolin, and I started playing mandolin, and I thought, man, this is really cool. And I met I'd known Bob Gibbons and asked him for some help, and he basically walked me through making an A-style mandolin.
Yeah.
And that really got me interested. You know, I don't know why, but to me, the mandolin, just, there was something about it that really interested me. So.
And he was making, I think his instruments have shown up in the magazine, he was making those really elaborate Tree of Life inlays, right? On the A-style mandolins, or is that somebody else?
No, I don't think that's him.
Okay.
I mean, he was a really incredible builder. He was kind of known for being his work. I would kind of describe it as being rough and ready.
Yeah.
And he's really fast. You see this even today, but he was one of those guitar makers who would almost prefer to make the jigs that make the guitar than to make the guitar themselves. Yeah. And he was really good at just figuring out how to make stuff really fast.
Yeah.
And so he helped me build an A model, and kind of a big part of making a carved instrument is making a carving machine of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
So he let me make a copy of his pantograph.
Okay.
You know, I found a machinist or a welder or something, and they kind of came in and looked at it and, you know, put something together for me. This would have been after I left Franklin. I was pretty much heading down that road. You know, I wanted to make mandolins, and making, you know, carving plates by hand is just, you know, you just could kill yourself. So, he was a really interesting guy. Kind of hard to get to know, but really also kind of a real sweetheart. I mean, if you asked him nicely, he'd do just about anything for you, I think.
Yeah. These days, you know, folks are starting to buy A-Styles again, but was that kind of weird that he kind of focused on A-Styles, or?
No, well, he built Fs too.
He did, yeah.
Yeah. So he was actually known for both. I chose to make an A-Style just because, you know, he was willing to help me, and, yeah. You know, I didn't, you know, I couldn't even imagine trying to build an F for the first time.
Yeah.
No, he built both.
Yeah.
His stuff was pretty good.
Yeah. And then did you focus on mandolins at first when you were on your own, or?
Yeah, actually, within the first few years, I was making flat top guitars. So I should kind of back up. Nick specialized in making
Martins, right?
OM, yeah. Kind of an OM 28
yeah.
style guitar. And I have to his credit, as far as I know, he was, if not one of the first, maybe the first small builder making OMs. Martin wasn't making OMs.
Hmm.
He was kind of ahead of his time in that regard.
And was he like a fingerstyle player, and that just spoke to him, or he saw the opportunity?
I think he saw that model as, I mean, it kind of recognized as what it is today, being kind of unique among the early Martin offerings. So, you know, it was like the triple O body, but with a long scale.
Yeah.
So Martin had made triple O's, but there was only a small period, as I recall, where yeah. they made a long scale. And I think he just kind of recognized that as being really a cool guitar, and he was he had met some people like Stefan Grossman and John Renborn, and those guys really liked that type of guitar, and they became early supporters
yeah.
of his work. So I think he kind of saw that as a niche that he could fill, and you know, he was making some really nice stuff.
Yeah. Did you take? You were building flat tops. Were you making OMs? Or?
When I left there, I really liked that style of guitar. So I was making some dreadnoughts, and I still make a what I call a concert model, which is basically an OM, but I've kind of rounded out the shoulders. Mm-hmm. You know, an OM has kind of squarish shoulders, so I kind of rounded out the top end and rounded out the lower bout. But it's you know, inspired by that guitar.
Yeah.
I don't really care for the, I mean, for a long time I would do, you know, kind of Martin style treatments like herringbone and certain inlay things, but I haven't done that for a long time.
Yeah.
So I still make concert flat top guitars, and I still make A-style mandolins, but I rarely get orders for those.
Yeah.
So you asked about mandolins for me. Within a couple of years of going out on my own, I was making A models, then I started making it F5s.
Yeah.
And I like the F5s. You know, they're a challenge, but I was never really interested in making a replica, like a lot of the people.
Sure.
A lot of the builders, you know, today and even back then, were really interested in making, you know, a dead-on replica. And there's a lot of builders who do that really well.
Were you in Sandpoint, which I imagine is in the woods? Small community. Is it in the woods?
No. Yes. North end of the state. Yeah.
Were you guys seeing vintage instruments come through? Or were you just kind of in this weird vacuum where everybody's doing their own thing?
No, it was a, kind of a vacuum for me. Yeah. I mean, Gibbons had seen a lot. I mean, man, that guy had a... Some of the stories, I mean, he'd been involved with Tut Taylor and probably mangle the story, but Tut Taylor and Randy Wood and
GTR thing,
GTR and yeah. and Groom, I guess.
Yeah.
So he was involved in that somehow, and he had one story about. How I guess he was working for them. I don't think he was a partner, but there was one story about how the whole thing kind of fell apart, and he ended up kind of leaving that endeavor. You know, pulling his truck up to the back of the shop and loading in what he felt was his part of the business and. Taking off, but he got to see, I'm sure, a lot of really great instruments. He, at one time, I think, built a lot of banjo necks. I think that was a big thing for him for a while.
Yeah. Did you transition from mandolins to archtop guitars? Was that intentional, or was that kind of over time more folks just wanted archtops than mandolins?
No, that was really intentional. Let's see here. Through the 80s, I was building mandolins and flat tops, and kind of mainly after a while became more known for mandolins.
Mm-hmm.
Around in the late 80s, I got really interested in archtops and moved to Seattle and started seeing more archtops. So kind of the opposite of when I was in Idaho, you know, you rarely see...
It's all bluegrass over there.
Yeah, you rarely see great instruments of any type.
Yeah.
If you went to a bluegrass festival, you'd see some great mandolins and guitars. Sure. But I moved to Seattle and started doing repair work on all types of instruments. But there were some players in Seattle here who owned some really nice archtops. I mean, you know, Stromberg, Gibson, D'Angelico, De Acquisto,
mm-hmm.
pretty much, you know, the iconic guitars. And so I started doing some repair work on those things, and it just really kind of just got really interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and about that same time, I realized that if I want to pursue this instrument, the archtop, the building F5 mandolins is a pretty intense instrument to build, and like I say, I was never really that interested in making replicas. I mean, and the contrast between building an archtop where you know, you can look at 10 archtops and learn something about each one and be influenced by each of those.
Mm-hmm.
With F5 mandolins, you're basically looking at, you know, a 3 or 4 year period in the 20s, you know, when the lower period of mandolins, and there's a little variation, but there's pretty much the form has been set in stone. There's not a lot of room for creativity.
Sure. smaller canvas too.
Yeah, I don't mind. I like the smaller canvas.
Yeah,
but just seeing the creativity, and so I could look at these, I could look at a D'Angelico New Yorker and kind of think, well, that's a really cool guitar, you know, or I could look at a De Guisto and kind of think, wow, look what he's, especially, you know, about that time he was really kind of changing his whole approach. Mm-hmm. And so I was seeing, you know, fairly new guitarists that were, where he was, you know, just blowing people's minds with what he was doing.
Yeah.
So it was pretty intentional. It was very intentional just to say, okay, I'm just, you know, I'm not really going to, I'd much rather focus on the arch top. Mm-hmm. And see what I can do with that. And, you know, I'll still build a mandolins. Mm-hmm. But, of course, within a few years, I mean, when you don't build an F5, people just assume that you don't build mandolins.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a good choice for me.
Yeah. So when you go and turn on the stereo, is it bluegrass or is it jazz mostly?
A lot more jazz.
Yeah.
I like jazz guitar. I like a lot of different things.
Yeah. Well, you just showed us your double top, which we're going to have video on fretboardjournal.com soon. So, thanks for talking.
Oh, sure.